Fear, Charlie Lutz said, is the desire for something that we do not want, and I would add to that something that we do not yet possess, something in the future tense, additionally of which we do not want it, yet we desire it, and that creates the fear. We desire what we don't want, something in the future tense. That's fear. Grief is something in the past tense that we once possessed, we no longer possess, that we desire to possess. That's grief. Anger is the desire to get even. Vengeance. What does the Bible say in the Old Testament? Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. In other words, karmic retribution is not for us to be the judge, jury, and executioner. It is none of our business. Nature takes care of that. For us to get involved, unfortunately, hate never hurts the people whom we hate. Instead, it hurts the people we love, principally ourselves, because ultimately we love ourselves. Or else we wouldn't exist. As Charlie said, to know the self, to love the self, to be the self. I mean, this is an extension of what ancient Greece says, to know thyself. It goes more than that. Maharishi gives us the facility to be ourself, but in the middle of knowing and being is loving the self. And Maharishi does say all love is directed towards the self, which means all hatred, all feelings, anything we feel about anybody is really directed towards ourself, not merely ultimately, but in the now, really, actually. So anyway, hatred I found in the past, more often than not, hurts the people we love. It does not hurt the people we hate, unfortunately. That's the way it works. So what have we left? We're left with the fourth negative emotion. We've covered fear, grief, and hate. The last negative emotion to define its thought or meaning equivalent is lust. So we've covered fear as the desire for something in the future that we do not want, but yet we desire it. Hatred is the desire to get even. And what was the other one? Grief is the desire for something that we once possessed in the past, we no longer possess in the present. Lust is, I'll see if I can remember this one. Lust is the desire, lust is the presumption of already possessing what we do not possess, regardless of whether it's past or future. So it's something that we presume to possess now. We imagine, but we actually believe that we possess it now. That's the foundation of lust. Yeah, I guess that's about as much as needs to be said about it. It's the presumption or the belief, or entertaining the belief as real, that we possess in the now what that which we do not possess. So it's interesting that both lust, grief, and fear deal with desire in contrast to actuality of possession in three different tenses of time, past, present, and future. Grief being the past, fear being the future, and lust being the present. So what does anger have to do with time? Usually has to do with the now, because it's a very short-sighted vision, very narrow vision, which means it could only be in the now. It couldn't be in any other time frame. Yet it's more than the other three, because it has to do with execution, moving forward. You know, vengeance is you want to do something, you want to take action, and anger is extremely motivating. So it involves the future, something you want to do in the future based on what somebody did in the past and how we react in the present. Namely, we feel it's justified that we get even, that we want to take out our revenge, our anger, on that other person or people. And you know, at the very least, just merely doing something to antagonize someone is getting even. You know, it's an expression of hatred. It's an expression of aggression. You know, a cousin of mine said there's a big, vast difference between assertion and aggression. And I told her, well, I don't understand. To me, they're one and the same. She said, well, no way. They are extremely different. And it may seem like a fine line difference in a sense, because they all are moving forward. But assertive is actually wholesome. You know, like drawing the line so that nobody crosses it to hurt you. And it means, you know, not putting up a sign saying, kick me, you know, and pasting it to yourself. It's not being vulnerable, in other words. While aggression is crossing the line to somebody else's space to do them harm. So that's the fine line difference between assertion and aggression. Assertion is you defend your integrity, and aggression is you attack somebody else's. I'm just saying that because it's kind of related to hatred, in a sense. One is to prevent somebody else's hatred from reaching you, and the other is you go out and you attack someone with your own blind hatred. You know, sometimes hatred can become such a way of life that we become blind to the fact that we are actually engaging in a behavioral characteristic which is, by its very nature, is hatred, the expression of hatred. We just get so accustomed to it, we don't even think about it, and that's what I mean by aggression. But vengeance is a more obvious version of hatred, because we consciously dwell or think or plan that, oh shit, you know, I really want to get even with that guy. And or we don't think about those things. We just feel it. We feel the hatred. But I've learned a long time ago that emotions and thoughts are flip sides of each other, and they probably have to do with the two sides of the brain. And we know there's a cabling connection of neurons connecting the two sides of the brain, and so I knew from my own experience that for every emotion there's an equivalent thought, and for every thought there's an equivalent emotion. Whether or not we're aware of the equivalence or what the other side of that coin is, so to speak, it's there. It just takes work to put effort and attention on the detail of trying to make discovery as to what that translation amounts to, regardless of which direction we're going, because it's a bi-directional translation. So I guess now I've thoroughly defined these four negative emotions of hatred, fear, lust, and grief. It was always a question or a mystery, a curiosity to me. What makes them so interesting? You know, there's four of them. You know, it's not three, it's not two, it's not five. Why is it four? And what is their nature? Now let's look further into this. There are four petals at the base of the spine on the Muladhara chakra. And those four petals have the Sanskrit letters. One is the letter V, which is the first letter of my name, and my name is the Sanskrit vibration of my being. And the other three letters are sibilants, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. In phonetics, they're called sibilants, the S and the two SHs, the two versions of SH in Sanskrit. And it's my belief that the three sibilants are the three states of consciousness of waking, dreaming, and sleeping, and the V sound is the state of transcendental consciousness, all four of which are transitory states. None of them are permanent. It's only cosmic consciousness that begins to become a permanent state. And then, of course, God consciousness and unity consciousness and, you know, anything beyond that, which Charlie said, don't worry about it, because it's vibrating outside the framework of the human nervous system to appreciate what it is those are. But he says evolution is continual. There's no limit to evolution. So he said, you know, he quoted Maharishi, don't worry about it. be that as it may, those first four states of consciousness are all transitory. Even transcendental consciousness does not last forever. By its nature, because all it is samadhi all by itself, while cosmic consciousness is the duality of living samadhi along with any one of the other three states, waking, dreaming, or sleeping. So, and even an enlightened person can go into the samadhi and, you know, meditate and go into samadhi and be without the three gunas, be without the other three states of consciousness. But it's not a permanent state. Eventually, the person comes out of that. So it's my, so I'm conjecturing now in the course of thinking about this topic that quite possibly those four sounds, those four petals of the first chakra are associated with these four negative emotions. In other words, the kundalini gets aroused in an awkward fashion before the physiology and the mentality and the morality and the spirituality is ready, of that individual is ready for the kundalini to rise. So consequently, some one or more of those four emotions are provoked instead of enlightenment, instead of the process of opening up a chakra. Whatever that enlightenment means for that individual, it's enlightenment for that individual is defined in terms of opening up the next major chakra in the series of seven major chakras. So if the person has already opened up the lower six, you know, from the third eye down to the Muladhara and everything in between, and the only thing left is to open up the crown chakra, then enlightenment for that person means opening up the crown chakra. That's the definition of enlightenment for that person, because they don't know anything better than what they have already opened up. But if the person merely opened up the first chakra, then enlightenment for that person means opening up the second chakra, if it's done in sequence. Charlie said the lowest four chakras do not have to be opened in sequence. You could skip ahead, you know, past the first and go to the fourth, and skip two and three. Eventually, though, you would have to open all of the lowest four before you could open up the fifth, because from the fifth onward, they have to be done in sequence. And he said most people do not open up the sixth one before they become reincarnated to be able to open up the seventh. They actually just come in with sufficiently good karma, and they've opened up the lowest five, and they're ready now in one lifetime to open up the sixth and then open up the seventh, both in one lifetime. I don't have that good fortune. I've taken the slow boat to China, so to speak. I've had to open up the sixth as well as the lowest five. Before I can open up the seventh, be that as it may. So, what it seems standard to good reason in the course of this discussion or this thinking, dwelling on this topic, is that the lowest chakra, because the kundalini is coiled up in the Muladhara chakra, it has been aroused before the individual is ready. And so either anger, lust, grief, or fear become aroused, rather than enlightenment, whatever enlightenment means for that individual, you know, opening up the next chakra in whatever is the lucky one that's going to be opened up, let's put it that way. And that's why, because one of the petals of the lowest chakra is being activated by the kundalini, rather than all four in a holistic sense, because there's another feature to kundalini, and that is that when it rises up the Sushumna, the middle path, the Ida and Pingala have to be, or maybe I'm pronouncing it wrong, maybe it's Ida. I'll say it's Ida. I'm assuming it's Ida and Pingala. They have to be in a state of balance. They're the positive and negative forces of prana in the nervous system, the left nostril and the right, associated with the left nostril and the right nostril, the right nostril being hot and the left nostril being cold. I'm assuming for a right-handed person. Maybe it's opposite, swapped for a left-handed person, be that as it may. They have to be in a state of balance, Maharishi says, in order for the Sushumna, for the kundalini to rise up the Sushumna and open up, you know, purify the Sushumna, you know, which would result in opening up the next chakra. You know, it might not open it up right away, but at least it might get get moving in that direction to purify it. And I think what happens is that if the person's not ready, then instead of the kundalini going up, it catches a whirlpool, so to speak, and gets caught in the first chakra, the very chakra that it's latent in, residing in a latent state. It becomes awakened and has nowhere to go, because it can't go because the person's not ready yet. So what does it do? It enlivens one of the four petals rather than rising up the Sushumna. And so the person either becomes angry, fearful, lustful, or grief-stricken. Or any combination of the above, or takes turns, you know, whatever. Instead of bypassing those four emotions entirely, those four negative emotions, and rising up the Sushumna. And I think that's what the problem is. Why those emotions get stirred up in the first place. Now, Gurudev, Maharishi's guru, was known to... The storyline is that he sought a master in his childhood, in his youth, who was free of anger and who was a lifelong celibate. In addition to the two traditional qualifications in India for seeking a master by a disciple, who was a living embodiment of the Vedas. In other words, he was well steeped in the Vedas and a living embodiment of the Vedas. It was not enough for Gurudev for those two qualifications. It had to be two more. He added two more. He had to be a lifelong celibate and free of anger. And it wasn't easy finding a guru who matched that high qualification of standard that Gurudev set for himself. It took him a few years, apparently, according to the storyline, tramping around the Himalayas once his family released him from their requirement to be a householder. And he eventually found someone who was like himself, free of anger and lifelong celibate and a living embodiment of the Vedas, as well as well studied, well steeped in the knowledge of the Vedas. So, I mean, Gurudev at that point was already very well steeped in the Vedas, but he wanted to become a living embodiment, and he was already a lifelong celibate, and he was already free of anger. See, the only thing he was missing was becoming a living embodiment of the Vedas. Anyway, to be a lifelong celibate and free of anger, I think, it's no coincidence that he added those two qualifications. I think they're related, and I think in this manner. Because he burned the seed of the desire for sex in a prior lifespan, and was already born free of the desire for sexuality. Now, what is sexuality? In my opinion, sexuality is the expression of anger in a positive way. In other words, instead of getting angry, getting even, we turn to sex. And it's taking action, it's assertive, and it may even have a little aggression to it. But, so it's not based on fear. You know, it may involve fear, you know. It's not based on lust, but it may involve lust. It's not based on grief, but it may involve grief. And so I think that's the way to define hatred, is that it's not based on the other three emotions, but it may involve them, which is a kind of funny way to describe hatred, that it's not based on something, but it involves it. I think because hatred is based on assertion, and it's assertion coupled with any one or more, or probably all three, of the other three negative emotions, such that it's able to move forward and take action, because fear, grief, and lust does not take action. It's based on an imaginary theme that the person entertains without taking action, but it's a passive stance. While hatred is anything but passive, you know, even though the person may not do anything with it, you may just sit there and boil, that's not passive, to sit there and boil. You know, he may be repressing his anger, but that doesn't mean it's not assertive. That does not mean it's not dynamic. You know, it's a dynamic quality. While fear, lust, and grief are anything but dynamic. They just sit there. They're static. You know, they just sit there. And they dwell on a fantasy, whether it's a fearful one, a grief-stricken one, or a lust-oriented one. They're just fantasies. Fantasization. A passive orientation. So, I think that's as much as I have to say, except that I have to give thanks to Guru Dev and Maharishi and Charlie Luce and Marty Zucker and all these people who have helped me understand, and Robert O. Becker and Leon Ernest Eamon and Peter Lindemann and John Bedini and Aaron Murakami and all Eric Dollard, all these people who have helped me understand electromedicine, the application in the form of kaya kalpa. In this particular stance that Robert O. Becker has taken, which has given me an understanding that I've never understood before, to the point now that I understand what the Fountain of Youth means, it means the ability to rejuvenate the body, kaya kalpa, whatever that entails. And currently it entails circuitry applied, you know, Robert O. Becker's protocol, applied according to the regimen, or the criteria, I should say, the criteria of qualification, shall we say, of Leon Ernest Eamon's biocircuitry, his cooperative healing. And it involves other people as well, but those are the two main guys that I'm basing the foundation of my protocol with. Now, there's an outgrowth of that, and it's the fact that Robert O. Becker got into the use of silver. And I think now I've come upon a way of applying a modification of an outgrowth of Robert O. Becker's study and research, inasmuch as the so-called Ponce de Leon Fountain of Youth, you know, that he was seeking, as a minor version, or playing a supportive role, of what Robert O. Becker and Leon Ernest Eamon have to offer us, inasmuch as a liquid, water, how to prepare water such that it takes on the characteristics of becoming regenerative for the physiology. So it's not just water anymore. It's rejuvenative. It has healing qualities to it. And it's simply an outgrowth of my studying the circuitry. But I think now it's the use of that water now today for the past, 8 hours, let's say. No, a little more than that. It's more like 12. For the past 12 hours or 14 hours or 15 hours, that has helped me understand emotion and kundalini and enlightenment and their relationship with each other in the Muladhara chakra in a way that I never would have understood before. It's helped me open up that understanding, because these are mysteries that are very important. Why do people get angry? Why are we subjected to fear, lust, anger, and grief, and become slaves to those four negative emotions, instead of simply bypassing them and just living out our life free of those four negative emotions? You know, we have a duty to ourselves to live our life free of those emotions and not be a slave to them, it's worse than a slavery, not be tormented, not be tortured by any of those four emotions. I mean, they're basically self-destructive in their own way, each in their own way. You know, seemingly lust, grief, and fear may not seem to be self-destructive, and even anger to a lot of people doesn't seem to be self-destructive, but they all are. All four of them destroy the self. Anyway, I think that's as much as I can think of to say on that topic. And I have nowhere else to put it but on this webpage devoted to kaya kalpa, even though I don't call it that. I call it the regeneration protocol of Dr. Robert O. Becker. In Sanskrit, I think we call it kaya kalpa. And for that, we have Agastya to thank for that concept, that desire to keep the body young and alive for as long as possible. And on all levels. Not just to keep it young, but to do what Patanjali says in one of his Yoga Sutras, avoid the danger before it arises. Well, isn't death a dangerous, risky proposition? The likelihood of death, the proximity of death, the possibility of death. I mean, this is what Gurudev sought to consider. What is the value of life when everything dies? All your loved ones, including oneself, will die. what are we doing about it? So he decided, okay, I'll become enlightened. And that way, at least I will have achieved something of value so that my death will not be in vain. And this was his decision as a 7-year-old when his grandfather died. He realized the purpose of life is to make life worth something before you die. And it doesn't mean becoming famous, which is an error of judgment on our part, which eventually results in death, or becoming wealthy. You know, it has nothing to do with those two qualities. It has to do with the purpose of life. And so, understanding the nature of these four negative emotions at least is a step in that direction. You know, it's like a partial enlightenment. It's a coming of age or coming of self-awareness as to some of the hazards, the pitfalls, along the path of life. The four negative emotions are pitfalls, that obstacles, speed bumps. But we can get caught up in that and not understand that it's not worthy of our attention. It's not worthy of our time to spend any amount of our time in any one of those four emotions, nor the thoughts that go with them, see? So we can now have an intellectual basis to analyze, why am I feeling this way? If I feel fear, it's because I desire something in the future that I do not possess in the present, that I do not want to possess in the future or in the present, yet I desire it anyway. Counterproductive to my own welfare. So why am I pursuing something that I know is going to be harmful, or I believe will be harmful, let's put it that way. It doesn't matter whether or not it really is. Belief alone is bad enough. And that brings on the fear. So why do I allow myself to engage in this? Make a different choice. Charlie said, the easiest way to change an emotion is to change the thought that stands behind it. So he was already alluding to the fact that for every emotion, there's a corresponding thought, and for every thought, there's a corresponding emotion, except he was placing thought as the foundation for emotion. So he was saying that one is predominant over the other. And so he was saying that emotions are subservient to our thoughts, and thoughts are masters of our emotions. And he also quoted, I think it was Lord Tennyson, who said, I am the captain of my ship. I am the master of my destiny, if I have it correct, who said that. And he said that for a reason, because he was, you know, and this was in another lecture. These are different lectures I'm putting together in one discussion here. Because if our thought is the master of our emotion, and if we make a choice to think that thought, then being subjected to the consequent emotion of that thought is our own doing. We have nobody to blame but ourselves. And if we want to change the emotion, all we have to do is make a different choice of what to dwell on, what to think about. It's our own choice. So it's all about making choices. And then he has, you know, another lecture to say about choices, you know, the people who, or just ourselves, you know, the failure to make a decision, you know, that. He says, making a decision is a property of the intellect, which is located in the brain, while thinking, thoughts, is a property of the mind, which is located in the heart. So the heart thinks, the brain decides. The mind thinks, the intellect decides. So it's simply a question of making a decision that can change our emotion. It's that simple. And another individual, I forget his name. Klaus, I think. Klaus? No. I can't remember his name. Reinhardt. He told a friend of mine, Patricia, that women have more blood vessels in the brain, which carries more oxygen to the brain, which is why they have a tendency to become more emotional, but they also have more power in their brain. And Patricia liked that. It was like a nice compliment, but, you know, power is a two-edged sword. It cuts both ways. It gives us more power, but it also makes the hazard of the wrong use of that power more risky, more dangerous in that area of our life. So we always take on a risk or a responsibility, let's say. We always take on a responsibility for being increasingly careful and considerate and cautious and conscientious whenever we take on increased power. And Charlie said, never seek power, because if you do, you'll go to the left. In other words, you'll go to negativity. Happens every time. Seek spirituality. Don't pray for power. Don't say, Lord, give me strength. Instead, say, Lord, give me your nature, I guess. Not power. How did he say it? I don't know how he said it, but I would think that if I had to cook up a way of how he said it, because I can't remember the words, or what he said for that matter, I would have to interject, Lord, give me spirituality. And how does Maharishi define spirituality? Being natural, being effortless, to be spiritual. To be spiritual is to be natural, and to be natural is to be effortless, something like that, a three-way association or equivalence. Now, to me, Charlie was the epitome of naturalness. Here's this Westerner, who was vice president of a corporation, a construction firm in L.A., a businessman, you know, totally establishment-oriented, came to the Friday night lectures always dressed in a suit, and always preferred that I come dressed in a suit and tie, and clean-shaven, you know, short-cropped hair, and yet he was the epitome of naturalness. And what did Maharishi tell him? There's even a picture with a quote on it, with the two of them. They're smiling, and they're like moving forward, they're leaning forward, moving in the forward direction, and Maharishi is telling Charlie to you be Charlie, you be you. I think that's the quote. Anyway, that's what Charlie said that Maharishi told him at one point. You be you, you be Charlie. And he said, yeah, okay, Maharishi. And somebody else said something similar. The 17th incarnation of the Buddha, the Karmapa, I think it was the 17th, it was the 16th. The 16th incarnation of the Buddha, the Karmapa, took Charlie's hands in his own hands, his two hands, and clasped them in his own two hands, and told Charlie, keep doing what you've been doing. Keep doing what you're doing. Something like that. And Charlie said, well, you know, I tried to. I'll do that, or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, I keep saying I've said enough, but I keep thinking of something more to say. I'm an inspired moment here in the middle of the night, in the dead of morning. In the wee hours of the morning. Yeah, I can't sleep. I was awakened, and actually, I'm making colloidal silver in the kitchen, so I got the timer running, so I can't afford to go back to sleep. I've given away a slight hint of what the Fountain of Youth is. Ooh. Well, slight hint, because that's just part of the formulation, anyway. Yeah, I'm not going to say the whole thing. I gave away a little bit. Okay, I'll let you guess the rest. I may want to patent this. I want to experiment with this first and patent it before I tell you what the formula is. Anyway, Oh, I'm getting a headache just dwelling on that. I may eventually just give it to you, you know. God only knows what I'll do. I don't know. Holding back may be useless. No, I think I will hold back. So I've said enough. I shall sign off now. Until we meet again. Happy trails to you until we meet again.
Charlie Lutz used to talk about the four horsemen of the apocalypse represented the four types of the human, and I can see now that those four types of human is directly relevant to the four negative emotions and their corresponding four thoughts. So adding to what I've said previously, what he said, the four horsemen of the apocalypse were there was the spiritual individual, the intellectual, the emotional, and the physical. In other words, the individual predicated their life on one or another of those four principles. They were either seeking liberation from the wheel of rebirth, or they were caught up in their intellect, or caught up in their emotions, or caught up in their body. And come to think of it, a person on the path towards liberation from rebirth could at any time be also, you know, alternately engaging any one of the other three modalities. And he related it to the colors. The white horseman was the spiritual. The gray, I believe, was the intellectual. The red, emotional. And I think the black was the physical. I'm not sure, but I think that's how he coordinated the symbolic color reference in the Bible with the four types of the human. So here is the correspondence. Transcending the letter V, the V letter, the phoneme V, the first letter of my name, Vinyasi, transcending, that's the spiritual, okay, the spiritual horseman. And, of course, that becomes anger when the kundalini can't arise properly. In other words, the person becomes active, but not in a spiritual mode. He or she acts with self-regard as to how or why or what, instead of letting themselves be a vehicle. And they may claim they're being a vehicle of the Almighty, but of course, that might be a different story. I mean, the anger, the self-righteous indignation or whatever, is a telltale sign that they're anything but spiritual. The whole thing about spiritual is that there's no presumption. There never is. Before the thought arises, during and after, is silence permeating the entirety of the thinking process. And if it's perturbed by any kind of emotion, any of the four negative emotions, in this case anger, it can hardly be classified as being spiritual. So, but I think that's the analog, because, or the analogy, the equivalence, because very often, let's make an analogy, another example, pride, spiritual egotism, Charlie said, is the worst kind of egotism. To think, oh, you're sitting high on your high horse, and you think you're what a great person you are because you're so spiritual, you're so religious, you're so moral. That's actually predicated on anger, of all things. It's not fear, it's not grief, it's not lust. There's only one other of the four that it could be, and it's anger. Pride is predicated on anger. It's actually anger that everybody else is not as good enough as you. You know, that the world is so shitty. So, the spiritual horseman of the apocalypse is analogous to the anger emotion, the letter V, transcending, in a very weird kind of way. Some of these are weird, they seem like weird. That's because the negative emotions are perversions, okay, of what ideally should be the process of transcending. It's like transcending averted, or subverted, shall we say. Now, the emotional nature, that sounds like the dream state. The intellectual sounds like the waking state. And the physicality, the person who's really into their physical body, that sounds like the deep sleep state, because that's what we do when we go to sleep, into deep sleep, and we don't dream. We're really basically just getting into our body. So that's the analogy, that the parallelism that I'm drawing here is between those four things, equivalences, to round out this discussion.